You're listening to the FQXI podcast, which brings us nicely to a cosmologist I had the pleasure of meeting in March, Tanu Padmanabhan of the Inter-University Centre for Astronomy and Astrophysics in Pune, India. Gave talks at Cambridge University and at Imperial College London, outlining a very different way of thinking about gravity.
Usually, we describe gravity at a cosmic level using Einstein's general theory of relativity, which tells us that space and time are woven together to form a four-dimensional fabric. Massive objects bend and warp this fabric. Our sun, for instance, would deform space-time something like a bowling ball on a rubber sheet, causing the planets in our solar system to fall towards it. That's usually how we explain the origin of gravity.
Padmanabhan, however, has been approaching gravity by thinking about thermodynamics.
Thermodynamics, that's the science of heat flow. How can that be connected to gravity?
Well, thermodynamics provides a statistical description averaged over many molecules. So, for instance, the temperature of a gas is a measure of the average motion of its molecules. And Padmanabhan and his colleagues have shown that it's possible to derive Einstein's equations by taking a similar attitude to the nature of gravity. When I caught up with him at Imperial, he explained to me just how this program works and how his team are using it to explain the origin of dark energy, the mysterious entity that seems to be causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate.
I am Tanu Padmanabhan. I am a dean at Inter University Center for Astronomy and Astrophysics at Pune, India.
You've been thinking about gravity in a slightly unconventional way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you and a number of other independent researchers, but it's still a minority way of thinking about gravity. So before you explain the kind of different way of looking at things, can you explain the conventional way about thinking about gravity in terms of general relativity and Einstein's equations?
Yeah, in the standard picture, it is very easy. You think of gravity as manifestation of space-time curvature. So the space is not flat, it is curved like a surface of a sphere or what you have. And it is described by a mathematical object called metric tensor, which essentially tells you how to measure distances and time. And then we have some field equations which determines these metric tensor or this gravitational field. So if you tell me how much matter is there in some place, I'll be able to tell you how that matter curves the space-time. And from that, I can figure out how gravity acts on everything else.
You're thinking about things in terms of not just taking the space-time fabric as kind of a fundamental component of the universe, but trying to think of space and time emerging from something else, some kind of atoms of space-time. Why think about it in that way? Why not just accept it the way it is?
So the first thing is that if you look at the conventional general relativity, there are several features which we don't understand. It turns out that if you take the conventional general relativity very seriously and you look at physical phenomena there, again and again, you are hit by the fact that there can be observers who cannot see part of the space-time. The classic example is a black hole from the inside of which you cannot see signals, but black hole is just a special case. There are a whole lot of cases where the light surfaces, that is the surfaces at which light is propagating, will block information from the observer. When that happens, it is accepted fact that you can attribute a temperature and entropy to these surfaces. So it looks very strange that gravity, out of all other interactions, have a thermodynamic description.
So let me just get this straight. When we say that we're talking about a thermodynamical framework, we're really talking about, you know, the sort of things that we learn in school when we're talking about gases and heat.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we are talking about. So the idea is that suppose you have told some 17th century physicist that you have matter, and he would have written down equations for gaseous matter or solid matter, which is vibrating as an elastic solid. And if you have told him that the matter is made of tiny, tiny molecules, he would have probably laughed at you. Okay. And in fact, Boltzmann was not taken very seriously during his lifetime. And this is exactly what Boltzmann said. He said that if a system has energy and it has temperature, then there must be degrees of freedom, microscopic degrees of freedom, which holds this energy in terms of the microscopic motions. That is exactly what is happening in space-time. Space-time has temperature, space-time has energy. Therefore, space-time should have microscopic degrees of freedom, which keeps this energy in it, just like a solid does or a gas does. Then, once you have that part, then rest of the thermodynamics follows. And you can do anything which you do with thermodynamics. So this is what motivated many of us to sort of look at it more seriously. Then we found that even in classical gravity, the standard Einstein gravity, several things which are unclear becomes much clearer when you look at it from a thermodynamic language. For example, the field equations themselves has a completely thermodynamic interpretation. You don't have to think in terms of a curvature being evolving, etc., etc. You can think of in terms of surface degrees of freedom and bulk degrees of freedom and how the difference between these two drives the heating of the space-time.
So you gave the example there of a black hole, and I guess when you're associating it with thermodynamics, I'm thinking of things like the results in the 1970s where Stephen Hawking discovered that black holes can radiate, Hawking radiation as it's called, kind of thermal energy. And I guess you're saying here, it's not just thinking about sort of the event horizon around black holes, but there are other kind of horizons maybe where we can't see what's on the other side of the horizon, perhaps because of distance. Right.
It is actually a very general phenomenon. This result which you are quoting came somewhere around 1974-75, and two gentlemen, Paul Davis and Bill Andrew, proved a result which in my mind is much more general. What they showed was that in any space-time, or rather their result can be reinterpreted as saying that in any space-time, there exists certain class of observers, and these observers will not access regions of space-time, and they will think of the space-time as hot. In fact, even in the black hole space-time, it is a kind of a myth that black hole has some temperature and everybody sees that temperature. If you take an observer who is freely falling into the black hole, he will view physics very differently from an observer who is staying outside. For the simple reason that the guy who is falling into the black hole has access to more regions of space-time. So in the same sort of way, if there are different observers in a given space-time, they will attribute different thermal properties to the space-time. And at any given point in space-time, you can construct observers. We call them local Rundler observers. And these observers will attribute an entropy and temperature to the space-time. So this result is much, much more general than just the kind of black hole thermodynamics which one thinks of.
You know, I guess this is something that is just kind of strange, like you say, that gravity and thermodynamics can be related. But, you know, where do we go with that in terms of thinking about the origins of space and time, or the atoms of space and time, or, you know, deriving equations to describe what happens with gravity?
Okay, so deriving equations part is easy. So let me start with that. What happens is that once you have temperature and entropy, and you understand that you want to have a thermodynamic description, the entire framework of thermodynamics is there to aid you. So all that you have to do, I did the most natural thing, namely to look at the heat content in some region of space on the null surfaces and say that this heat content should be maximized. It is somewhat like maximizing the entropy. So thermodynamics tells you what to do. You just repeat it. And lo and behold, this leads to a nicer version of Einstein's equation. First of all, it gives you Einstein's equation, which itself is remarkable, which tells you that your standard Einstein's equation can come from a completely thermodynamical variational principle. Second, that version has some very nice holographic properties. That version tells you that you can attribute degrees of freedom to a bulk three-dimensional region and degrees of freedom on the surface of that three-dimensional region. And the difference between these two is what drives the evolution of the space-time. And finally, it gives you equations in a form where we have hope that the cosmological constant problem, which is probably the most important problem in theoretical physics today, can be tackled.
You know, I guess this brings us to the question of what are the molecules of space-time?
Yes. So that we have not yet answered. So it is somewhat like, again, asking an 18th century physicist what the atoms are made of. If you go back again to, say, 17th century or 18th century physicists, they knew how to measure the total number of degrees of freedom in a gas. It is called Avogadro's number. But they had no clue what they are measuring. So in the same sort of way, you can use Einstein's equation to measure what is the total amount of degrees of freedom which is there in some region. And you can actually calculate that. This we have done. And that turns out to be essentially you take the area and cut it into small Planck area bits, and every bit counts as one. Many of us are working on that, and we have some ideas as to what the microscopic degrees of freedom is probably going to be. And there are two ways of looking at this question. One way of looking at it is, whatever it is, it could be, say, string theory, if it is correct, then the strings are the fundamental constituents of what space-time is built out of. And what we need to do is to come up with a thermodynamic description of these strings, which matches with what we are doing. So what we are doing is something like a top-down approach in length scales, and there is a bottom-up approach in the length scales, and these two has to match at some stage. That is one way of doing it. And we have some ideas as to how to proceed further. But the remarkable thing is that even without knowing what it actually is, you can say very non-trivial things about it. This is exactly what 17th and 18th century physicists did. They did not know what is the molecular constitution of matter, but they could very well describe vibration of elastic solids or gas dynamics of ideal gases without any problem. So it has a tremendous amount of power in this approach. And as I said, we have an approach in which you can actually try to understand why the cosmological constant has the value it has from this approach.
So this is related to the problem of dark energy. So in the late 1990s, astronomers realized that the expansion of the universe is accelerating, but exactly why it's doing so is a mystery. They attribute this now to the presence of something called dark energy. And many cosmologists think that one of the best candidate explanations for dark energy is something called the cosmological constant, which is a measure of the intrinsic energy of space, which could be pushing it apart and causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate. So please explain, how do you solve the problem of the cosmological constant? How, you know, people have struggled to explain why it's so small. So how does this come out of your work?
Okay, so there are two ingredients to this. The first point is that the way people usually think about cosmological constant is some kind of a problem with a constant. But in this approach, it resurfaces as a problem with gravity, so to speak. That the gravity should not care about the zero level of the energy. If you shift the energy up or down, gravitational equation should not change. It turns out that the emergent gravity paradigm, where you think of it as thermodynamic, has this naturally built into it. I emphasize that it was not sort of designed for it. So it is an extra bonus, and that I think is very important, that this theory naturally ignores the shifting of the energy levels. Second, it also tells you to think about space-time evolution in terms of degrees of freedom on a surface and on a bulk. At a very fundamental level, the degrees of freedom which is on a Planck length sphere is actually 4 pi, because it comes from the 4 pi r square divided by r square being 4 pi. And this remains as a conserved quantity as the universe expands. So using this number 4 pi and putting it into the equations, it turns out that you can actually explain the observed value of the cosmological constant. And any change in this due to shifting of the energy levels of matter is completely ignored in the formalism. So as a result of which, you have both the ingredients which you need for solving the cosmological constant problem. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you to Tanu Padmanabhan. There's an extended version of that interview on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. You'll also find a link to an article that Zia wrote for Nature about the origins of space and time, featuring his research and the work of many others.